Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. The date is March 23rd. It is our first full week of The Attitude actually doing our show remotely. Like the rest of the world, we are adjusting to a very different life and a very different experience. But The Attitude does something that it will continue to do between now and November of 2020. And that is, we begin our show every single day with the voice of Colonel Vindman, as he testified in November of 2019 before the impeachment, during the impeachment hearings. And of course, that memorable line that you heard was, "It'll be okay, Dad, I'll be all right." Well, not only was he not all right, we're not all right. The voice of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. So we go to Vox a lot. And the reason why we like Vox is that it always gives us incredibly great content and fabulous people to interview. And the other day I saw an article at Vox Recode. And it was by a reporter by the name of Sarah Morrison. Sarah Morrison covers personal data and privacy. She previously covered technology's impact on the world for Vocative. Her work has also appeared in The Atlantic, Jezebel, Boston.com, Nieman Reports, and the Columbia Journalism Review. She is a graduate of Wesleyan University and Columbia Journalism School. I want to welcome Sarah to the program. How are you, Sarah?
I'm okay. How are
You're
you?
Okay. Well, as okay as anyone can be, I suppose, at this point in time. The reason I reached out to you was that you wrote a piece and you said to me, "Look, Arnie, I'm not an expert." I said, "I get that, but you talk to all the experts." And that's the beauty of talking to a reporter, is that you pull in different pieces and therefore you give us a better picture of what the challenges are. And your piece was entitled, "Why Life-Saving Ventilators Will Be in Short Supply for the Foreseeable Future." And I want to let you know that we taped the show on Monday. It'll air tomorrow on Tuesday. So I had my MSNBC on in the background just before you came on. And there was a physician from Boston that was on the air. And he talked about the fact that this idea that we needed these complicated machines yesterday is really, he described it as our moonshot. That was what he said. And what he said was, there are three things we have to worry about: production, distribution, and operation. And to some extent, your article talks a lot about all those three things. But the reason why I think the timing of your article is so important is that I was Googling ventilators. And as I was Googling ventilators, I came across something that just took my breath away. It was an article from ABC News. It was entitled, "Hospitals Trying to Figure Out How They Would Ration Ventilators," right? And I'm just going to read a couple of sentences from it, but I don't want to be those doctors. Not only are they burdened with trying to save lives, now they're going to have to figure out which lives. And that just seems to be so unfair. And how the article begins is this way. Faced with more critically ill COVID-19 patients than equipment to treat them, New York hospitals are mapping out how they can ration care and equipment in order to save the greatest number of patients possible. In the last days, internal memos from a chairman of the surgery at New York Presbyterian, one of the city's largest hospital systems, raised alarms that the estimated crush of coronavirus patients within the next month would require 700 to 934 intensive care beds, well beyond the current capacity. The Queens branch of New York Presbyterian is actively putting together a committee to help make such critical care determinations in an emergency, so individual doctors would know what to do at the moment it matters most. According to emails reviewed by ABC News, that hospital has already convened an ethics committee to address the triage of ventilators. In layman's terms, this is a process that dictates how medical staff would decide which patients are assigned ventilators in the event the numbers of patients needing those breathing machines surpasses the number available in hospitals. And at the very end, it's talking about the fact that Governor Cuomo has said over and over again, his state has a current number of 6,000 ventilators, which is inadequate to meet the surge of patients. This is the number Cuomo suggests. We will need, I want everyone to hear this number, 30,000 more. 30,000 more. With that, Sarah Morrison, let's use your piece as kind of our roadmap about why life-saving ventilators will be in short supply for the foreseeable future. And maybe you can start by reminding everyone exactly what a ventilator does. I can't imagine anyone at this point not knowing what a ventilator does, because we've been hearing ventilators morning, noon, and night. But I think it's really important for us to understand it, because it's not a simple machine.
It's not. You put a tube, breathing tube down a patient's windpipe, and they push a mixture of air with a certain amount of oxygen in it down there, which sort of mimics how your lungs naturally inhale. And then I believe you can exhale on your own. I think maybe there's some that do both inhale and exhale. But basically, it mimics what your lungs do naturally for people who can't do those things.
So I posted something else on Facebook, and I posted about the fact that there was an article at the Jerusalem Post, and someone said to me, oh no, it's fake news, it's fake news. And the article at the Jerusalem Post said that there was a doctor from Italy who basically said, if you require a ventilator and you're over 60, they're saying no. And someone said, that's not true. He went to Snoops or whatever it is. And then you continue to read all the different articles, and it may not be a precise number, but in Italy, it's getting to be a precise number, because they also have an ethics committee that's weighing in. So let's talk about the fact that we need, you know, this incredible number. And you said that there are about 170,000 ventilators in the US, but that 960,000 people will need them. So let's talk about, how do we approach the most important thing, at least at the very beginning, is where the hell are we going to make them, find them, invent them? What is the challenge as you are putting your article together?
The challenge for me, or the challenge for people who need ventilators?
Actually, probably for both, because you know, so much new information is coming in.
Like you said, I cover data privacy, which isn't exactly medical devices or ventilators. So the challenge for me is getting enough information so I can present it to the rest of you accurately.
Right.
The challenge for getting enough ventilators is, like you said, in America, it's estimated we have 170,000 more or less. And they estimate that, and I think there's been various estimates, but one of them says almost 1 million will be needed by the time this thing runs its course here, which doesn't mean they'll all be needed at one time. And the thing, you know, that we're trying to do, and why I'm talking to you over, you know, Zoom, why we're all like sitting in our various houses instead of, you know, in person, is to try to sort of spread the need out so that ideally everybody who needs one will get one. And then another part of that is having enough and building, you know, creating more to sort of satisfy any need that we
So we know that, you know, Donald Trump is talking to Elon Musk, and he's talking to Ford, and so everyone's talking to all, but these companies don't make ventilators per se. You know, they make cars, they may do a moonshot, whatever, they may like send things, but they're not in the ventilator business. But I know that there is a way, and I think as you were doing your article, that they're beginning to figure out a way to maybe take the machinery they have and reconfigure it in order to make a ventilator. But the other thing I learned in your article is that you know, most of these ventilators have to go through these incredible examinations. Are they safe enough? Is this working? They have to meet a standard. Who the hell has time for a standard when you needed it yesterday? And yet, I guess, as you were doing the article, how do these people think that they're going to be able to transform their companies and their equipment in order to make something that is both not necessarily the most sophisticated, but needs to be accurate and good at what it does because it's about saving lives?
Yeah, I mean, well, we know Elon Musk has a habit of saying that he can do extraordinary things with technology.
Like Donald Trump in some ways, exactly.
I mean, that he may or may not know how or be able to do. And I think even at this point, he said that when it comes to ventilators, it's going to take a while. It can't be instant. And I think he even said at this point, it may, by the time they're able to really produce them, the real need may have even passed. So I think even he is being kind of realistic. I mean, that said, you know, in wars, we've had, you know, car companies switched over making airplane parts. Right. So this isn't an airplane, and cars and ventilators are not quite, cars and airplanes, you can sort of see the similarity there. Cars and ventilators, yeah, maybe not as much.
Yeah.
And then also, like you said, it's a medical device. It's a very important one. Right. So you really need to have, you know, the things that make it, and then you need to be able to pass the tests. And
exactly.
Normally, it would take a very long time. You can always fast track certain things.
Yeah, Ken?
Excuse me, Sarah. Can you maybe lay out, paint a picture for our audience of the production, not the process, literally the scientific process, but of the companies that now make ventilators, how long does it take to make them? How many can they make per week, per month? And then what next rung of companies could be reasonably expected to convert to making ventilators like cars to airplanes were in World War II? What kind of, I don't know, heart valve makers, I don't know what it takes to make a fake lungs, artificial lungs, makers could maybe make a ventilator. How much that would take, and then sort of add it all up and get a picture of how we can cope with this, getting eventually to the Elon Musks who may figure out how to make a ventilator after the crisis is over.
I could say a little bit to that, but I couldn't say too much more. I wouldn't want to, but I can.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked to a guy named Frieden. Who is Frieden? F-R-I-E-D-E-N, where he basically said that they're complicated pieces of equipment and there's no simple way to rapidly increase production. This sounds like a guy who's making the stuff and he knows that, you know, I'm already in the biz, but it's going to be really hard to sort of up the business.
Yeah, he is the former head of the CDC, I think, under Obama. So he knows a lot about a lot of medical stuff.
Right.
And then, basically he said, you know, it's a very complicated machine, a complicated process, a lot of things, moving parts. I think I read in the LA Times, I think today, they talked to a company called Medtronic. And they
Out of Minnesota. I know Medtronic.
I think so. I think it might be in Ireland, too.
Okay.
But they said they use about 1,500 parts to make a ventilator, and they have more than 100 different suppliers for these parts. So you can see right there how this production chain, how complicated it really is. Because if you're going to start making them, you have to be able to make. It's really a supply chain thing, right? There's only you have to set up supply chains, you have to order things, you have to, those places have to be able to give you enough. Then you have to have the talent, skill, and machines to assemble them.
Well, the other problem with the supply chain is I have a funny feeling I know where a lot of the supply chain is. Can I use the word China? Yeah. I mean, and you know that. I mean, we find out that China has a lot of the supply chain for our pharmaceutical drugs. China was the one that was making a lot of the masks. China, I mean, it's and we have such an interesting relationship with China that it's really frightening. But Sarah, as I was getting ready to do your show, there were two things that jumped out at me. And I just want people to know how creative companies are. While this may not be the high-end piece of equipment that we're talking about right now, the ventilators, we know that what we absolutely need are those masks, the N95 masks. Did you see the story out of Cape Cod? There is a company that makes equipment for deli takeout. Okay. You know, those little boxes and those little things you use. He has figured out a way to make these N95s at 300 a minute using his equipment to do deli takeout. So I just want people to know that what seemed yesterday to be impossible, who knew that there'd be a connection to deli takeout to, you know, a mask that will make a huge difference in people's lives. And so in the end, all these pieces I think are important as we look at the need for a ventilator, which is, I think,
isn't the problem, though, the issue of quality, both in terms of not hurting people and also being effective in doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, Medtronic, I happen to know, is a company that had big class action lawsuits against it over badly manufacturing the products that it was supposedly equipped to make. And now we're going to ask them to convert to a process that they don't even know about and produce.
I'm going to disabuse Ken. I don't give a crap.
Medtronic does make ventilators.
It does. And, but what I am going to say is that most people are now going to not be looking at the liability issues, and there may be not all perfect machines, but I think people are going to look at the idea that they get 98% more perfect than the 2% that are less perfect. Just as an aside, Sarah, many, many years ago, I went to England with my first husband, and it was actually, we were there to hear Ralph Nader talk in England. Do you believe this? And we were talking about tort law and about liability issues. And you know what I found out interesting, Ken? You know how doctors complain a lot about liability issues and they're like, oh, no, this is our problem. In England, they got rid of the doctor liability issues after they passed universal health care. So they did a let's make a deal. They said, all right, we'll cover everyone with universal health care and we'll basically almost not eliminate, but almost weaken the litigation bar that would, you know, take you to court, because we're gonna get rid of some of those liability issues. So I just want people to know that at a time of a crisis, I think the liability issues are going to be less likely. As you were doing this article and you were talking about the fact that right now where we might have enough ventilators, but we look like we're on the cusp of Italy. And that in Italy, they don't have enough ventilators. As you were putting your article together, did you talk to anyone about not only having the ventilators, but who would be able to operate the ventilators? Did anyone talk to you about that? Because operation doesn't sound like, it's not a switch.
I didn't, but I know I've read that is an issue too. I think I read somewhere, so it's like, I think it was like three people to one ventilator, but again, quote me on that, but I mean, you can see how they run 24 hours, right? So right. You want to, I would assume, have at least one person
right
for those 24 hours.
Right.
And then I think also there's just an issue of how many people are able to do them, because I don't think it's just something that anybody who happens to work in a hospital knows how to do. They're in ICU, in ICUs. So they're, I don't know exactly where, how far down on the sort of medical professional food chain it goes, but like I said, there's sophisticated pieces of equipment that do important things. So
right, and you point out that right now they're not cheap; that they range between $25,000 and $50,000, and that's before the crisis.
Yeah, God, you'd hope that they weren't like marking those up. I mean,
but you see what they're doing with masks. Masks used to be like 80 cents, and now masks are like, you know, $3 and $4. So at a time of crisis, a lot of things change, including the price. It's going to be so interesting to see what happens as we move ahead. But I think necessity is the mother of invention. Maybe Elon Musk will be able to deliver them before the crisis ends. Maybe we'll be able to see like Ford and whatever. And maybe we'll be able to go back to China. There was another interesting article about some guy who had wanted to go to China and had bought a series of ventilators. But guess what, Sarah? He was having difficulty bringing them in because of our tariff wars.
So,
even when you have them so close, you may not be able to actually deliver them to the place specific. So again, it's going to take a rethinking of a lot of things, including that. All right. You wrote another piece at Vox. So yeah. Tell me about my taxes and about filing them. I've been confused. Am I supposed to file them? Am I supposed to not pay them? What the hell am I supposed to do? Because, you know, right now, I love my accountant, but I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to be in the same room with him. I don't want to be near him. So what has the federal government decided to do with our federal taxes? And what does that mean for states that piggyback on the federal taxes?
Well, it's very related beats here. Taxes. I think what you said, I don't want to talk to my accountant, might be a big part of why they're doing this too. Just that don't encourage people to meet with their accountants when, you know, we're not supposed to really be meeting with anybody.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
Another form of social distancing.
Yeah. Excellent. So I guess last 2 weeks ago, maybe at this point, they pushed the filing deadline was April 15th, which it has been. But, you know, you had to file by then, but if you owed anything, you could wait up to 90 days to pay it without incurring any, you know, interest or penalties. And then last week, they ended up just pushing the filing date up to July 15th as well. So basically, tax day is now July 15th instead of April 15th. Obviously, you can file before that.
Right.
And if you are owed tax and you can see your accountant or don't need to file them, do it as soon as possible. Why not? If you have to wait, you can't July 15th with no, for your federal taxes with no penalties or interest.
So I love the federal government doing this, but a lot of states piggyback on the federal taxes. So right. if you're not required, I mean, at the beginning we were filing and now we're not even filing. So we're not filing, we're not paying. We've got till July 15th, hallelujah. Like I might have a job again. But more importantly, exactly. But more importantly, did you talk about what other states are doing since they are piggybacking on the April 15th and now it's July 15th? Are they basically going to be seamless and just follow the feds? Which means, you know what that means? That means less money is coming into state government, and state government is already overburdened responding to COVID-19 because all their revenues are gone anyway.
Yeah, so that's a problem. I don't know how big of one, but it seems like, you know, maybe not a small one. So when I wrote this, it was very early stages. So a lot of states hadn't changed theirs from April 15th. But right. the expectation was that they probably would just follow the federal government's lead. And I think California, maybe other ones that even had pushed theirs already. So California had pushed theirs to June 15th. Yeah. I just checked today and, you know, sure enough, Connecticut's now pushed theirs to July 15th.
Yep.
The Connecticut actually said before that it's April 15th, but if the federal government changes it, we'll probably follow suit. They have.
Okay.
And California is also now July 15th. So I think chances are good. Your state, whichever one you were listening from,
right.
has probably pushed theirs to July 15th. I wouldn't assume.
I would check.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So likely you'll probably you'll have until July 15th to file everything. But like again, check first.
Well, you know, the reason why this is an important conversation to have is that it's not just a federal story. It's actually also a state story. And that is one of the big issues right now in the bailout. We're number three for the COVID crisis is how much money is coming back to cities and states. And while the federal government made this decision, that's fine. The federal government can make that decision because they can actually incur debt. They can keep incurring debt. Mm-hmm. Most states can't. All right. They're not allowed to carry debt. So therefore, when they make this decision to delay to the July 15th date, it is going to have a more challenging situation for them. And that's another reason why when you see the bailout, there really needs to be huge chunks of money coming in for cities and states. I mean, it just has to come in because they're already on the front line. And this is also going to address and undermine their revenue stream, which I think is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I mean,
and also thinking about it from the point of view of the things that the states and localities buy, they have to pay their vendors.
Right.
And the vendors are more small. The federal government pays Lockheed Martin. Well, Google, they get paid this year. They've got plenty stored away. But if the state is paying its police and fire and environmental cleanup crews and stuff like that, those people need to get the money so they can pay their mortgage. Or
states can't do deficit
buy food.
Spending. States can't do deficit spending. That's most states can't, and that's what's so interesting. They have this requirement that they can only spend basically what they have, and so it'll be fascinating to see how this July 15th, and that may be your next story for Recode. You know, like how are the states, you know, rearranging the chairs on the Titanic as they're trying to figure out, okay, we're following the Fed's lead, but it has enormous financial consequences for us. Something that we're not seeing as a result at the federal level because they have this huge ability to basically print money is what they have that you don't really see at the state level. So
yeah,
it's going to be fascinating to find out.
Some states don't have, I think, an income tax at all. So
New Hampshire, New Hampshire.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're in New Hampshire.
Right. Oh, shut up. Shut up, Sarah.
Live free or die.
Yeah. Well, actually, Sarah, what you don't know about
sadly.
Me. No, but Sarah, in 1992, guess what I ran on? I ran on an income tax, for governor. Obviously, Arnie lost. So this story of income tax. But I will share with you before I let you go, and thank you so much for joining us, is that as we're talking about these tax issues, my state has like the highest property taxes in the country, of which in some cases for some individuals, that tax can represent 15, 20, 30% of their income in taxes, property taxes. And if you don't pay your property taxes, the interest on the non-payment is out of this world. It's huge. It's like 8% to start, then it goes to like 18%. It's just a huge amount of money on the interest. So there is a discussion right now, I'm not sure about waiving property taxes, but if nothing else, waiving the interest on property taxes owed. Because again, the taxes themselves have no relationship to anyone's ability to pay, unlike an income tax. And more important, if it's like 25% of your income and then they're told you have to pay interest, people are going apoplectic. So all these tax issues are also not just revenue issues for states, but they're financial burdens and a greater sense of insecurity.
And in addition to no interest on your back taxes also, maybe postponed foreclosure dates because people are worried that if I don't make certain payments on my town obligations, I'm going to lose my house to the town.
And, so Sarah Morrison, I'm going to let you go, get you off the hot seat. I'm so glad that you write for Recode. We know you're not the expert on ventilators, but at this point, there are very few people in the world who are expert on ventilators. The only thing we're expert on is we don't have enough of them. How do we make them tomorrow? And is there a way for us to, as this one doctor said, create the moonshot? You know, we're going to land a man on the moon, said JFK. Well, now what we have to do is we have to land a ventilator in every hospital in America that needs one to save lives. And we have to flatten the curve over and over again. We hear that. So as we shelter in place and you shelter in place and my producer Ken shelters in place, The Attitude thanks you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone, stick around. Yeah. A little Climate Connections is next. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about, so how are they going to make those payments from Washington that's going to actually get to you when you don't have a job? Boy, is that a challenge. We'll be right back. Thank you so much. Look at what happens with the states with the new July,
get money back and a refund. I don't know the numbers on that, but it'll be
interesting. Absolutely.
But at least at the state level, Sarah, in our state, I used to work for legal assistance, and a lot of people lose their homes to the town because they haven't paid their tax bill.
And that's not going to happen. That'll be a hiatus.
Well, that has to be enacted into law so that we know that it's a hiatus. We know.
Well, guess what? In my little state, there's an executive council meeting on Wednesday with the governor. I think this is coming up. Anyway, Sarah, I know too much. All right. Thank you so much. Mwah. Goodbye.
Bye. Take care. Thank
you. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Diane White-Husick is a biology professor at Moravian College in Pennsylvania. She studies how climate change affects forest habitats in the mountains of Appalachia.
And I had been thinking a long time about how to engage people in conversation about climate change in a state that has a long history of fossil fuel use, especially in rural areas where it's kind of controversial.
So in 2010, Husick started the Eastern Pennsylvania Phenology Project. She asked local residents to submit data about when they saw certain flowers blooming, trees leafing out, and birds returning in the spring.
I thought it might be interesting to think about what are people noticing in their backyards? Perhaps a way to start a conversation that wasn't politicized right from the beginning.
She says the project helped her build relationships with local residents and organizations who now trust her expertise. She's been invited to speak to fishing and hunting groups. And she says people call her up to talk about what they're observing in the region.
And they contact me to say, hey, I noticed this change. Do you think it's due to that stuff you work on? It's almost like they still won't say climate change, but they're talking about it and asking about it, which I think is a huge change from just a few years ago.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2005. That was the day 15 workers were killed and another 170 were seriously injured in an explosion at the BP refinery in Texas City, Texas. workers were restarting a unit down for repairs. As they filled the tower with gasoline, it overflowed, sending a geyser into the air. The igniting hydrogen vapor cloud created a chain of explosions that destroyed the nearby trailer housing temporary contract workers. The explosion shed light on many key problems throughout the industry: the increasing use of contract workers, safety shortcuts, and qualitative lack of industrial process controls. A 2007 Chemical Safety Board report found that years of cost-cutting, poor worker training, and a safety culture with serious deficiencies left the plant vulnerable to catastrophe, but company leaders ignored the warning signs. OSHA fined BP $21.3 million and more, but ultimately settled for $13 million. For years, the catastrophe was studied closely to eliminate the hazards. But 10 years later, a 2015 joint investigative series by the Texas Tribune and Houston Chronicle found that, quote, "There is little evidence that the 15 lives lost on that March day brought much of anything. The death toll at U.S. refineries has barely slowed. At least 64 energy company employees and contractors were killed in the decade before the blast. At least 58 have died in the 10 years since. The Department of Energy has tracked nearly 350 fires at refineries in the last 8 years, almost one a week. Refinery workers have gone on strike, demanding, among other issues, an increased emphasis on safety. For the United Steelworkers, it is a daily fight to implement the critical safety actions the union developed in the aftermath of the blast."
Of the attitude. It is our Tuesday edition, March 24th. If you've been following the insanity in Washington, it's like, you know, Mitch McConnell gets up and he like chastises the Democrats. And then Schumer gets up and he chastises the Republicans. And then Nancy Pelosi jumps in and says, no. And they're fighting about who gets the money. How do we direct it to them? Do big corporations, are they in the line? Should they be in the line? What expectations do we have? How poor do you have to be to get a check? How rich can you be and still get a check? What's the delivery system? You know, what if you don't have a credit card? What if you don't have a bank account? And I'm just listening to this and I'm going, oh my God. And then of course, lucky me, I go to Econofact, like who else goes to Econofact? And I see an article by a professor at the Stanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Her name is Professor Lisa Janetian.
Correct.
All right, Janetian. And I'm going to call her Lisa from now on, so forgive me. And she wrote an article that after I read it, I almost had to reread it because I was trying to figure out what the hell she was telling me because it seemed so complicated. And then I realized maybe that was the point. The title of the article: Challenges of Equitable Rapid Response Cash Payments. Don't roll your eyes, because this is about everyone that's listening. Trust me. And I don't care whether you're a big business, small business, or some guy unemployed, or some guy collecting Medicaid and Medicare. So Lisa, welcome to the program. And explain to me about the fact that this is not a new concept. Countries around the world have done it. Some of them have a system in place already, just not libertarian, you're on your own, Jack, United States, basically is how I feel. So explain to me the history.
Yeah, I think, you know, the starting place of that article, and actually I think the missteps that are happening now with all this conversation about infusing cash into the hands of people, is that the US does not have one system, one platform, one mechanism that will equally reach every American. And no one's talking about that. So let me lay out some ways of sort of organizing our thoughts. I appreciate the article is kind of confusing. And you're right, it is complicated. And my concern is that the easy way is going to be the path forward. And the easy way is going to affect the people who need it the least versus reaching the people who need it the most, because reaching the people who need it most is going to be complicated. So there are two things going on here, big picture, right? Cash infusions to the hands of Americans are designed to boost the economy. It should happen as quickly as possible. It should happen to increase consumer demand. It should happen to boost the economy. And we do have some systems to reach many Americans. We have the tax system. We have the Social Security Administration system. We have the postal system. And the point of that article is, yes, we should use all those systems, but let's not forget that many people in our country are not attached to systems, right?
Right.
So this gets to the second point, that there are economically vulnerable, many of them, individuals in this country. They're getting hit the hardest with this pandemic because they're losing jobs. They're not attached to the formal economy, many of them. They don't have paid leave. Right? They're not on payrolls. They might not be eligible for unemployment insurance. They're the ones that are going to not only experience short-term negative hits, right? How am I going to get food on the table today for me, my kids, my family? But this is going to have a spiraling impact. You know, not eating today means being in poorer health in the near future, which means when jobs come back, I'm not going to be able to re-enter the workforce. So there's huge long-term effects.
Well, and let me just also throw that the reason why they're all looking for some sort of a cash payment is because of the crisis of the pandemic. And if you are not eating and your health is crashing, then you are more susceptible to getting ill, then you are more susceptible to draining the system. So the vicious cycle that we are talking about is, it's beyond comprehension.
Right.
So the reason I talked about your article being confusing, not that it was a confusingly written article, it's that when I realized all the moving parts, you understand the challenge.
Right.
So what I would like to know is, before we move into our pathetic situation in the United States, what do other countries do? Because you begin by talking about the fact that this is actually done in other places. What kind of a system exists that, I mean, maybe for the future I need to be aware of, but I just want to know what other countries have done, because obviously they have figured out that there may be a time, like Andrew Yang talked about, where everybody would get something, but Andrew Yang didn't talk necessarily about the system. He talked about the cash. I'm just sort of curious what other places have done.
Yeah, so there's a lot of conversation about concept, which is fine. This is the Andrew Yangs and the Chris Hughes of the world. Right. And small piloting of those ideas. But again, they're super small and they're literally like face to face. Here's your money. Go use it. What we know from the rest of the world. So cash transfers have been used in various ways. They've mostly been used in the context of humanitarian aid. Right. And supporting people living in unstable situations. So you think about the refugee settlements, for example, that are happening. Worldwide. The thing with those situations is that they are kind of, let's call them disaster emergency responses. What happens is a charitable organization, like a organized structure, kind of helicopters in and is in the business, right, of handing out this cash. And it's usually a pretty targeted population, pretty easy to identify in a very kind of time-limited organized way. And these organizations are in the business of doing this. They know how to deliver money, foods, and goods to people who are experiencing some kind of crisis. Okay, so that's only of limited right help here, because we have an entire country that's experiencing a crisis. It's not a limited population, targeted, or a time-limited issue. Okay, so then we can go to the other types of systems, like in Finland, in Britain. There have been examples of infusing cash into the hands of people, and they have relied on their general social delivery system. So in Finland, the test has been through their unemployment insurance system. Why does it work there? Well, most people are attached to unemployment insurance somehow, right? Most people have some kind of formal job. They're getting a pay, some kind of payment.
So the gig economy isn't as significant in Finland as we're seeing in the...
Right. Part of this is right. The gig economy has a different role. Part of it is there isn't probably as much informal labor as there is in America, right? So it works. So even if... even in those cases, you might not be getting 100%, but you're getting much more than you would in a devolved kind of system in the U.S. So I just lost, I think.
Here's my question.
Okay. So can I just say, though, it's not that it's hopeless. I mean, we can set these things up in the U.S. We just aren't prepared to do it right now. You know, there is a way to come up with a structure that can be verifiable, and it just takes... it just takes more proactive policymaking and thinking in advance of how do we give cushions to people in the case of a crisis. And we have not thought that way in the US.
Lisa, when I was in grad school, I recall people talking about a negative income tax as an idea in the United States. The negative income tax, which is kind of like the reverse of the income tax, and even Nixon administration was approving of it back at the time in the recession. And it's like Andrew Yang's $1,000, only it's ongoing. It's like the opposite of the regular tax system, where people who earn a lot of money pay some portion of it into the government. People who earn a sufficiently low amount of money get money back from the government.
Right.
And Lisa, couldn't that be sort of a structural basis for doing this? And even after the coronavirus is over, it could be a way of ending poverty.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tax system is an extremely promising system, right? For it is probably the one that's most universal, above and beyond the US postal system and sending people by the way. Which has like a whole bunch of other different problems related to people moving and, you know, fees with check cashing and this kind of thing. So I agree. It might be time to look back at how the negative income tax experiments thought about distribution. You know, we do have a little bit of information today, about a credit called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which
Reagan put into place.
But you know, even there, 1 out of 5 eligible families don't file.
Right? Or they don't file. Am I right?
Or they file and they don't get the refund for whatever reason. And we also know there's a lot of predatory behavior around trying to get those families into filing and systems.
So people don't know about their right to file.
So, you know, we still have a lot to tackle around the tax system, but yeah, it's definitely a promising mechanism.
So Lisa, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is they're talking about targeting the money that's going to be going back. So if you make under 75,000, you get 1200, but then if you're really poor, it turns out you only get 600. And then the question is that, you know, how do we determine, you know, 7,500, but if that was on my income tax last year and this year, I'm at zero, or I had 150,000 last year. And because I lost my job for whatever reason, I mean, you're looking back at the past, but the past is not a precursor to what's happening right now.
Yeah, I'm not so enthusiastic about, you know, when I looked yesterday, there were 17 different proposals apparently about how this cash transfer should be, implemented. I am less enthusiastic about the ones that have phase-ins and phase-outs and minimum income requirements. You know, that's just a lot of additional burden. It's not going to work. It's not going to get money quickly out into the hands of people.
So what I'm hearing from you is what I was suggesting the other day. Give a check to everyone, not income sensitive, like, you know, just like we have public education. You can be rich, you can be poor, you can just walk in the door if you have a kid. So if we made a situation where everybody got the check, as someone said, but what, the 1%, the Bill Gates don't need it. I said, well, then we can claw it back next year. If it turns out that, you know, you have income in excess of such and such, and we saw that you received a check, we just tack that on to your tax liability. I mean, there's a way of doing doing it, but right now we don't have the time, the energy, or frankly, I don't care what last year looked like. I just need to make sure that you get a check today.
Right. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think it's I think the way to move this quickly is that something should get to everyone. Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify this language around checks, that checks will not get to everyone, right? And so, you know, one of the proposals I saw, I forget who it was, is thinking about debit cards, you know, prepaid debit cards. So that's has certainly those can be done without any fees. You know, I'm involved in this study now where we're giving cash to low-income moms. We're doing it through, we're doing it monthly. We're doing it through a debit card. Mm-hmm. And we know right away, they use that money. They're taking it out with to get dollars through ATM machines.
Right.
They're using them for point and sale online. They're using them at stores. Right. So we know that we can move the economy or we can meet basic needs through this kind of debit card mechanism.
So you said that if it's simple, it's probably a mistake. So now that we know that we have-
So in terms of disbursement mechanism.
Right, I capisce, right. In terms of disbursement. So, and I don't mean like the money is a mistake, I mean disbursement is a mistake.
Right.
So what I'm trying to figure out is, as you have looked at this, and we know that there are people that are unbanked, and then there are the homeless,
right.
And then there are people that have moved, so they don't necessarily have a postal address, and then we know that people don't file taxes. So if you're going to be looking at the buckshot of trying to figure out how you're going to deliver a check to everyone, what is it that people are proposing that recognizes the complexity of this problem and still wants to make sure that 98.9% of the Americans that need it will get their check? Because not only do they have to eat, and you're assuming they still might collect food stamps, but only 85% of people who actually should be awarded food stamps even collect their food stamps. But as you're looking at this, how the hell do you roll it out quickly? And does anyone have a plan in place that says, first you try A, then you try B, then you try C? I mean, I'm just kind of curious as to who's developing something that will actually get the dollars there.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of creative conversation around that now, maybe today, including mm-hmm. This conversation on your show.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you first have to sit in a place and say this has to be multi-pronged.
Right, right.
I mean, just right away. And right. I mean, I don't see that being discussed in Congress. But
no.
Again, tax system, SSA, veterans, administration, we have social service benefits. Many people are getting them. They can be used as mechanisms. We have EBT cards that are out there, electronic mm-hmm. benefit cards, right? For people who
right.
are receiving benefits. So right. you're right. That can get pretty close to a lot of the population. So that's one like big multi-pronged, think about multiple systems. What else can you do? I think you have to, it has to come from the ground up. I mean, the people that are difficult to find, economic vulnerable, the people that are gonna know that are the community organizations, the nonprofits, the schools.
Right, exactly.
Exactly right.
Exactly right. You know, they're the ones that are gonna find individuals who are not connected to big
right.
federal systems. So I think it has to be both.
So I'm just, what I'm kind of curious is, what I'm thinking about as I'm processing this in my head, because I used to be a poverty worker, okay?
Yeah.
So those are my clients. Yeah. And what I keep thinking about is that there's like a master list, okay? These are the people in your community. These are the people we know from the public schools. And then what you do is you look on that master list and you realize that, you know, there are still 74 people on that master list in your community that have not necessarily got either a check or an EBT card, but you might know how to find them.
Right.
You might know how to connect to them. And to a large extent, that is the public schools. That is the right. Girls and Boys Club. That is the homeless shelter, for example,
yeah.
or the food kitchen.
Yeah.
And in a way, you almost want to reach out to them and say, okay, we've got these people. Do you know where any of these people are? And have you serviced them recently? And, you know, this might be a way for us to identify them. And, you know, there's a sense of privacy that seems to be lost, but in a way, it's kind of like the master checklist that in a way it says, these are the people in your community. You're not targeting people because they're bad. You're just saying they need their money.
Yeah, yeah.
There's two things I would say about that. One is certainly the community organizations, the ones, the social workers and volunteers who go out under the bridges and walk around and talk to people who are homeless and make sure they have food and blankets and whatnot. They know who's out there in the community much better than anybody else does, certainly much better than the school system does. That said, also, when you mentioned privacy, it made me think, you know, if you're an undocumented immigrant, somebody who doesn't have papers, do you want people finding them? And do we, as social engineers who are deciding what Big Brother should do, do we want Big Brother going out and searching for all the undocumented immigrants, and then after they find them, ICE comes along and sweeps them up and deports them?
So I guess my question to you, Lisa, is, are the 11 million undocumented even part of any of this conversation?
So it's interesting, the proposals, at least the ones I saw yesterday, they have, they vary on citizenship verification or not.
Okay.
So it's certainly, you know, some of the proposals are pretty wide open. We didn't mention another thing, which is, in theory, social security numbers can be used as a quick, right, verification technique.
Yeah.
Again, you're not going to catch folks who don't have social security numbers that are residing in this country. I don't know, you know, I just don't, we're using the word search, and we're using a lot of words that are, again, are going to be a lot of investment in time and resources. So, you know, these are difficult points. So do you reach the 95% of the population with all your existing systems at the risk of not reaching 5%? Get the money out there.
Right. So here's my suggestion. I mean, I think you get the 95% out. You have to. And because as you point out, these are going to be paying rent. They're going to be paying for food. They're going to be paying the electric bill. I mean, if I'm worried about, you know, my big energy companies, they want those checks in those individual hands, because those are the checks that are going to pay for the gasoline. Those are the checks that are going to pay for the electricity. In a lot of ways, by giving it to everybody, you've given it to the economy, and you've given it to a lot of businesses that are tanking. Right. So I think, I mean, people need to understand, you are actually giving the money to big business. Can I repeat that? You are giving the money to Walmart because people are going to go food shopping there. You're giving the money to Target. You know, I mean, it's like some people are saying, oh, I'm so worried about big business. Trust me, by giving it to, you know, 95 or 100% of us, that money ends up going there because no one's socking it, putting it in the sock drawer. I mean, it's just
there
not
is a
going
difference
there.
Between sending it to big business as
yes.
profits that they can cream off the top versus giving it to people who get food in return.
Right. Exactly right. So, Lisa, before I let you go, we've talked about this kind of complicated system, and we're going to be as creative as possible in order to make sure. What are we talking about in the way of the amount?
The amount per person or per family?
Yeah.
Yes, that's also had.
Yeah.
So, again, we don't have a lot of concrete evidence to support amounts that'll make a difference. Here's what we know. The earned income tax credit on average is $3,500 to $4,500 as a lump sum payment for the working families who are eligible and file and get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, has a big impact on their lives. You know, I'm involved in a study now where we're giving these cash gifts. We did decide to give about the equivalent amount of $4,000 a year, but we're breaking it up monthly. Mm-hmm. So that's about $333 per month.
Mm-hmm.
Our families are residing at about $20,000 to $25,000, right? So they're right at poverty. So this is a 25% increase
in
their income. And, you know, we only have anecdotes at this point, but it's doing these small things like paying the rent and getting food on the table that matters a lot for families. So Andrew Yang's proposals of $1,000 a month, you know, they're not, unfortunately, we don't have a whole bunch of evidence.
Right.
I don't think that should deter, right? Moving this as quickly as possible. I also don't think this should be an indefinite plan. You know, I think getting money out as quickly as possible, multi-pronged strategy, think about checks, think about debit cards, reevaluate in 3 to 6 months. If we could have a really nimble way of doing that.
Excuse me, are you talking about Congress? I'm sorry, Lisa. I'm just really nimble, really nimble.
I can just talk about economics.
I know. I'm just laughing. The word nimble and Congress, it's almost like it's an oxymoron. They just don't go together. Well, you know,
nimble.
I always love the way economists talk about the assumption is that we live in a perfect world.
That's right.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Well, it's going to be fair. All right. One last thing.
Yes.
Do we, when they talk about small business, and that they're the engine of the economy, how the hell do you define a small business?
Oh, that's interesting. So from the perspective of paid family leave, right, it's 50 or fewer employees. And you just have one policy oriented way of defining small business.
Okay.
That probably covers most.
Okay. All right. They everyone throws words around and I get frightened because I don't know what the terms mean.
Right.
You know, and like my biggest, everyone keeps talking about, you know, expanding unemployment and expanding sick leave. And when you're in the gig economy, you got none of that stuff. I mean, so, you know, sick leave, who's got a sick leave? I work 24/7, you know, who's got unemployment? It's going to be so interesting to see how that works. And of course, the other real challenge that no one has talked about is what happens about your connection to job and your connection to healthcare. Because right now we connect jobs and healthcare together. And if you are, you know, unemployed and used to be in a healthcare structure, they may have to cover you for, you know, a certain point in time, but you can't afford COBRA, you know? And so it's also going to sort of really shake up the whole model of insurance, because now if all these people suddenly find themselves unemployed or underemployed, the ability to access the healthcare system is going to change dramatically.
Yep.
And that's you know, and of course I'm the Medicare for All baby. And on that note, Lisa, challenges of an equitable rapid response cash payments. The title sounds like a lot of jargon and stuff that's so complicated, but never in your life have you wanted to know so much about this topic as you do right now, because we are at a brink that we have never been before. And unlike the Great Depression, you wanted to work. You wanted to find a job.
You know, the upside here is maybe this will spark some innovation and thinking about our systems in our country when the dust settles on this pandemic, which could be a really optimistic, good outcome.
Well, I'm lighting candles because I hope that is the outcome. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor Lisa Jeannetian is at Duke University. She is at the Sanford School of Public Policy. And if you go to EconoFact, you will find her piece. We'll post it on our Facebook page. Thank you so much and take care of yourself.
Thank you. You take care too. Bye-bye.
All right. Ciao. All right, everyone. We will talk tomorrow. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. Ciao. Stay well.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring, or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing, and you may not know. Smile on your brother, everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. Some may come and some may go, he will surely pay his. When the one that left us yet returns for us at least, we are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another right. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love.